Your SteveJonesShow.com podcast audio is loading now. Today's SteveJonesShow.com podcast audio is sponsored by Purdy Insurance, Market Street, Sunbury, and online at PurdyInsurance.com.
Sports talk where your voice counts. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motors Studio, here's Steve Jones.
Welcome, Sunbury Motors. Williamsport Open here. Tomorrow, it's the home opener for the Williamsport Crosscutters at 7:05 at historic Bowman Field. Tickets available here tonight. Tickets available tomorrow night in Williamsport. Today's show brought to you by Purdy Insurance, Market Street in Sunbury. Go to purdyinsurance.com. And the Hilsers General Store hotline is open at 1-800-795-9565. That's 1-800-795-9565. Powered by a store located on Route 1115. The manager of the State College Spikes for 2013 is 26-year-old Oliver Marmel. I had a chance to sit down and talk to him about developing players at this level.
Very pleased to be joined by State College Spikes manager Marmel, and Ollie, welcome. And you don't get this view in your league ballpark.
This is unbelievable. I played at some nice facilities, but even as a visiting club coming here in 2007, I wish we could call this home. So now that we have the opportunity to do that, we are very excited.
You, in fact, become the first manager of the State College Spikes to actually have played a game in this ballpark, albeit with the opposition. So you get a little slice of history tonight, which now brings you to your playing career. What was it when you sat down to talk with the Cardinals, where they identified you as managerial material on this level at such a tender age?
No, it's very exciting. The first assignment they gave me was to be the hitting coach at the Gulf Coast League level, and I did that under Steve Turco in 2010. And then they asked me to be the manager last year in Johnson City, which was a complete honor. Just to be asked to do that for this organization means a lot to me because I played for them and I consider them the best organization in all of baseball. So to be a manager at my age for them is unbelievable to me.
When you played, you're concentrating on being a player. But when did you start concentrating and thinking about, okay, why did he make that move? Why that move? How did he put that lineup together? When did those questions start creeping into your mind?
It was the last year of my playing career with the Cardinals. I started to step back and kind of look at things a little differently. I started to feel that my playing time was close to being done with. And I actually remember a time with Tony La Russa was addressing the whole spring training camp. And I was sitting there, and the whole time he was speaking, I was actually receiving the information more for I want to use that when I'm in a role or a position where I'm managing rather than receiving it as a player. So that's when I started to tell that, man, I really want to do this managing thing at some point when my career is over.
You've talked, and when we've talked to you before, about Mark Dijon and Mike Schilt being two very good role models, mentors for you. Yet when I remember working with DJ back in 2006, there's no doubt who his mentor was. It was Tony La Russa. Even though he no longer manages within the organization, what are some of the things that have filtered down from him that then filtered down to other people that actually filtered to you that you know that's how it needs to be done?
If there's one thing I can say is attention to detail and be excellent at the small things. That's one thing that would be communicated at all times is the big things, they'll take care of themselves, we'll focus on them, but we could be excellent at the small things, then that's when you have an elite club that continuously goes to the World Series.
Mike Matheny's in a spot where he knows what an Adam Wainwright could do year to year. Matt at what he can do year to year, what John Jay can do year to year, or Alan Craig. You're in a spot where there's turnover in personnel and it changes. What's the learning curve for you on personalities as well as talent?
We kind of just keep it light in the clubhouse. We have a lot of guys that we're bringing with us from the extended spring training program. There's a lot of guys joining us from the draft. So basically we have the guys that are here with us for the last 2 months, and the new guys kind of see how they run things, how things operate. As far as personalities, we just kind of let them be themselves.
You know, what do you look for? What do you try to read that will then help you develop them?
Yeah, honestly, the first couple of weeks, I just step back and do a lot of observing, see what guys need to be pushed, see what guys need a pat on the back, see what makes them tick. And all these guys are different. Not one of them are the same. So the first 2 weeks, myself and the staff just sit back, observe, especially the new players that we haven't seen before, and just kind of get a good feel for what they're like, what their personality is like. And then after a couple of weeks, we kind of get after it a little bit.
Talk a little bit about your staff.
Staff-wise, we have De Niro Roscoe, who will be the pitching coach. He's Venezuela. He does a very nice job with the pitchers, has a good relationship with them, and just carries himself in a very professional manner. And then we have Ramon Ortiz, also known as Smokey, who's just a character. He's great for the clubhouse. The guys absolutely love his work and just being able to work with him in the cage. He keeps everything light. He knows when to push, when to step back and have some fun. So the dynamic there and the chemistry that we have within the staff, I think, is going to work out really well this year.
On this level, what is a game day like? When do you get here? When do you start putting together the lineup? When do you put them through their paces? Give the fans an idea of what your day is like.
As a staff, we get here. We got here together today around noon. We'll get everything settled in, the lineups, kind of what the pitching will look like, different situations. We'll just go through the whole deal as a staff. Once we're through with that, we post the lineup for the guys. Once they get here, they can see it. At 3:15, we'll stretch as a staff, as a pitching staff. And then at 3:45, the rest of the guys will stretch, and we'll have a little workout where they'll take an infield, hit BP, go through the whole deal, and then go in, rest for a little bit, and then we'll open up.
And then after the game. It's not just the game's over. Hey, see you guys. Take care. We have to take off. What's the routine after the game, and what do the Cardinals expect in your report?
Absolutely. After the game, we kind of anything that needs to be done with the media, we take care of, and then the players, we make sure everyone's settled in. They're gone. As a staff, we sit in the office, and that's when we do our reports. Basically, we report on everything that happened in today's game, every pitch that was thrown for a ball, a strike, errors made, hits, big hits, two strike hits. I mean, you name it, it goes in that report. So everything from their performance to how we saw them, how they're progressing from day to day, all that goes into the report that's read throughout our organization.
Say, for example, guy goes out there and he has a, quote, 0-for-2 night. Fans see he had an 0-for-2. But in the 0-for-2, he dropped down a bunt and was able to get a runner to third. Guy on second hit to the right side, gave himself up, got a runner to third. How important is that in a report on a guy?
And that's the importance of the report. And he wouldn't be really 0-for-2 in our eyes. He's really 2-for-2 with quality plate appearances. So what we call a QPA, quality plate appearance, he was able to lay down the bunt successfully and move the runner successfully. Therefore, he executed both of those at-bats perfectly. So for us, that goes in the report as he did his job, rather than what the fans see as just 0-for-2.
Yeah. How do you then evaluate a pitcher's report? When Dernier goes out and puts his report together, what are some of the things that you know the Cardinal way? What are some of the things they're going to look for that goes beyond, oh, he won an inning and a third, and, you know, what will they put in?
A lot of it goes into pitch selection, but also just their composure and their poise on the mound, how they handle certain adversity, ground ball to short, guy makes an error, how he handles that, because at a higher level, if it's going to happen, you got a packed house and there's yelling. Is he going to be able to keep his composure, continue to pitch, execute his pitches, and stay under control? So all that stuff, besides just the pitches being thrown, also goes into account.
Ollie, you managed last year in Johnson City. How different were you in the first month compared to the last month? What were some of the subtleties that were different?
I felt like the blinder started to come off a little bit that first month. I was really just locked in on certain things and couldn't see what else was going on the field. As the season continued to progress, you start to pick up on little things and manage the game a little differently because you're not so focused on just your job. You're kind of seeing the overall picture. So, it happens every year where you're just kind of locked in. As I continue to progress through my career as a manager, then hopefully I'll start to pick up on the bigger picture as well.
The next part is, do you saw this team in Williamsport and extended, I assume? Along the way? No, you didn't see him at all. So this is your first time through. of a series against a team you haven't seen compared to now game three of the series? How do you, what is the difference?
We're most focused on just executing our plan as a pitching staff, as hitters. We're just focused on what we can do. We really don't have a whole lot of information on them. Obviously, I have some stats from the past years. but basically, we're just trying to execute our plan and have these guys just to develop what they do best and work on what they need help with. But really, we're not focusing so much on what they can do. If we execute what we can do, then we'll see at the end of the game where we're at.
What do the Cardinals do to make life easier for Latin players? Because let's face it, you know, Johnson City, where East Tennessee State is not going to have a heavy Latin culture. I can assure you in no uncertain terms that's, you know, there's not a heavy Latin culture here. So what do the Cardinals do, and what's their philosophy on how to handle that part of it? Because it's going to be unfamiliar for them.
A lot of it has to do with preparing them for this. In extended spring training and in spring training itself, we have English classes for them so they can communicate with people outside of just the field, which gives them a level of comfort. If they can go to a restaurant and order their own food, there's a level of comfort there. And also, while they're at the field, there's staff members that are Latin and bilingual that they can communicate with. So that also helps, and that there's a lot of thought put into what staffs are put together for certain for here, for Johnson City, for the Gulf Coast League, so that there is someone that they can communicate with if something is to go wrong.
The importance of integrating everybody in the roster, because it is development. How much do you have to keep that part in mind as you go through? You know, say things go great and you're on an eight-game winning streak. Well, yeah, the temptation is to keep running the same guys out there, but that's not your job. So the important, give me the importance of that and how much thought you put into a lineup because of the development part.
Absolutely. You said it. It's a temptation, but it's also not my job. There's a temptation to just continue to roll the same lineup out there and continue to win. But one of my responsibilities is to make sure that we develop each one of these players. So, the temptation is to continue to win. If we're continuing to develop these players the way we're supposed to, then it shouldn't hurt us so much to throw a guy in the lineup, see what he can do. And you just work around it and put guys in certain situations where you think they can succeed. But our number one responsibility, especially at this level, is development.
You spent, obviously, time as a player in Batavia. You know what it's like there. So with all this question is with all due respect to Batavia and to Dwyer Stadium and so forth. But does a facility like this aid development?
Yes. Absolutely. Especially in the minor leagues, it becomes a grind for these guys. It's a lot of games, not a whole lot of days off. When they can show up to a park, that especially what we're looking at here is unbelievable. The facilities are nice. The hitting cages are nice. It gives you a little bit of life to show up to work every day and do your job. And then once they step on the field, if you're comparing it, let's say, to an extended spring training where there's no fans, it's still a nice facility, but there's no one cheering for you. It becomes a grind. When they step onto the field tonight and they have all this place packed out and people are yelling, absolutely, that's a fun environment to come to work to every day.
In extended, usually it's a lot of morning work, isn't it? It's all morning work. So now what about the adjustment for those players to adjust their schedule because the vast majority will now be evening work?
Absolutely. I'll speak for myself. I'm extremely tired by 10 o'clock now because, I mean, we're used to being at the field by 5:30 in the morning. We play at noon, and then we're out of there by 3:30, 4 o'clock, let's say. So now to readjust and be in – shooting seventh inning, you know, at night, and it's time where they're usually going to bed, they'll adjust quickly. It's important that we got here 5 days in advance, got some workouts in, got some night workouts in to kind of get used to it, but I think they'll be fine.
Ollie, thanks so much.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Oliver Marmol, the manager of the State College Spikes for 2013. Not just talking about the Spikes, you know, we didn't talk about personnel and players, but what it's like being a manager on the minor league level and the consideration you have to put in as a manager. The same things, for example, Nelson Prada is going to have to do with the Williamsport Crosscutters. Today's show brought to you by Purdy Insurance, Market Street in Sunbury. Go to purdyinsurance.com. Kevin and I back in a moment on News Radio 1070 WKOK.
You just don't think about insurance. You buy a home, you take out a policy, and you forget about it until something happens and you need it. Then you think about insurance a lot. My agent recommended insurance from Selective. Insurance for our home and property, jewelry, even the food in our refrigerator. Selective thinks about everything, so I don't have to.
Selective. Responses everything. Get to know us at Selective.com. Get to know your local Selective agent, Pretty Insurance, on Market Street in Sunbury or at prettyinsurance.com. Find out what Pretty Insurance can do for you.
Ready for a quality pre-owned vehicle? Well, get them before they go to auction at Sunbury Motors. Go to sunburymotors.com and click on Pre-Auction Blowout.
Your dream car, a 2010 Ford Roush Mustang 427R, just $33.99. And get ready for these deals. On a 2008 Honda Fit HB Mansport, a 2011 Ford Escape 4-wheel drive XLT, a 2010 Chevy Traverse 4-wheel drive 4-door LT, a 2012 Ford Econoline Wagon, 2011 Chevy Equinox, and a 4-door 2010 Jeep Wrangler Unlimited 4-wheel drive Sahara, and a 2012 Ford F-150 4-wheel drive Super Crew 145 Raptor feels so good that you have to call for our lowest price promise. 888-536-8017.
All come with a Carfax report and our lowest price promise. Pre-auction blowout. 24-7 at sunburymotors.com, at the North 4th Street Auto Plaza, Sunbury, and at our dealership, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. Sunbury Motors, a tradition of trust since 1915.
Drew Kelly on drums. Sean Carey on bass. They're part of the Shamokin Dam Orchestra. Yeah, baby. Great to have you with us. Opening night, New York Penn League tonight. We'll be at, you think about it, we've been able to take the show to so many different areas, Kevin. We've been able to take the show, obviously, to Chicago and the Big Ten tournament. We've been able to take the show to Marion and the U.S. Open. We've been able to take the show. We're going to go to Pocono next month. Here at the ballpark today, I mean, we've been able to go a lot of different places on this show that maybe hadn't gone to before.
Oh, that's why I'm glad the Sunbury Motors studio is on wheels.
Yeah, my wheels.
I mean, yeah, that makes it all, that makes it easily done when you put it on wheels.
Yeah. Yeah. Last year we were at Live for Life last year. We're going to do the same thing again this year. I have the show from Live for Life. Get some player interviews on like we did last year as well. I think this is, it's fun. Fun we're able to do things like that. So, your rant coming up at 4:40. It's a part of our regular feature. We've found out through extensive market research your rant is very popular, pro or con.
Yeah, either love it or hate it. There's no in between.
No, there really isn't. Or it causes a rolling of the eyes.
Well, most of them have caused a rolling of the eyes now that you mention it. But and of course, if you have a rant suggestion, I'm more than willing to take those at on our Hillshire's General Store hotline at 800-795-9565. Or you can email Steve Jones at WKOK.com. I'll take your rants there, too.
Fabulous.
Love and rants. You can respond to rants that way as well.
Yes, you can respond to rants. You can.
It's all about interactivity.
I want to talk about and being at the U.S. Open. One of the items that was talked about extensively, and you saw the commercials for those who watch the Open, and that is the pace of play. And that is the While We're Young promotion. Arnold Palmer with Clint Eastwood at the 7th at Pebble. Tiger Woods lining it up, looking, lining it up. It turns out, you know, the major. And something that there this in certain neighborhoods, for example, they want to build a development around a golf course, and the developer wants to have the greatest golf course going. I played El Conquistador once. Same thing. Neighborhood was built around the golf course and so forth, and it's a gated community and blah, 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 you know. But it's not normal. When they build these things. Build a golf course that people can play. All right? Do it in such a way where, we talk about rough. Well, I was just at a tournament for several days over the weekend where I saw penalizing rough. Now, Kevin likes it when the golfers struggle and they're 1 and 2 over par and so forth. I think, to me, a good U.S. Open score should be 4 and 5 under par. And here's the reason why. Okay? What made Jack Nicklaus's victory in 1986 so memorable at the Masters? He birdied 12. He birdied 13. He birdied 15. He took his iron on 16, right? And his son was caddying for him that day, and he hit the ball, and he bent down to pick up the tee, and his son says, "Oh, be the club." And Jack said, "It is," right? That was it is. And he just missed a hole in one. He knocked that one in. And then the famous Vern Lundquist, "Yes, sir," was a birdie on 17. Okay? What got everybody juiced up? Birdies, charges, things like that. If you were on the 18th hole at Marion for 2 days, do you know what you saw? Or do you know what you didn't see? For 2 days at 18, not one birdie was made. You should feel in a golf tournament somebody has a shot to string something together and isn't just trying to survive.
I think you need to find a happy medium, though, between the one over winner and the 12 under, 13 under winner.
Well, I mean, this week they're at the Travelers. In fact, Justin Rose, who won, and I saw several of Justin Rose's holes that he played, and what a smooth swing he has. Beautiful swing. Nice touch around the greens, but a beautiful swing off the tee in the fairway. I was really just impressed, and he's a guy that's had promise forever. Okay? Well, I mean, when he got home to the clubhouse, there's no way he's thinking to himself, look, he's going to play at the Travelers this week. Winner at the Travelers is going to be probably 12 to 18 under par. I don't want that at the U.S. Open either. But a 3-4 under par score? Yeah, I'd like to see that. I'd like to see like maybe 10 guys under par fighting it out a little bit. I think you have to be careful as to how you put it together.
Taking your calls at 800-795-9565. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now, from the Sunbury Motor Studio, here's Steve Jones.
4 minutes away from the rant. People have missed the rant. They've told me that.
And I'm more than happy to oblige.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. I hear you. Back to the pace of play, brought to you by Purdy Insurance. Market Street in Sunbury. Go to purdyinsurance.com. Sunbury Motors Studios, mobile today. Sunbury Motors, 4th Street in Sunbury. Sunbury Motors, Key Routes, 11 and 15, Hummel's Wharf. And the Hilsers General Store Hotline, open at 1-800-795-9565. Powered by Hilsers General Store, 7 miles south of Sealands Grove on Routes 11 and 15. Go to www.hilsersstore.com. Again, our number, 1-800-795-9565. 1-800-795-9565. Pace of play, though, I talk about golf courses. I mean, penalizing rough and things like that. How about reasonable rough that people can play out of? You remember, most of the people that make up the backbone of what you're doing are not single handicap guys. Single-digit handicap guys are probably belonging to a private club anyway. And if you're playing on a public course, you have to make it a public course in such a way that allows them to play and get something out of it. Now, there's a big responsibility on the players. You as a player have a responsibility to know who you are. It may be nice to say, okay, I'm going to go out. I want to hit from the black tees today and see what it's like. Pick 6 o'clock in the morning on a Tuesday when nobody's out there. Okay, and then do that because your round is going to be longer, and the amount of time you put in is going to be much more. Or if you want to pick the blue tees, but for the most part, pick your skill level. If you are a guy that should be hitting from the white tees, hit from the white tees. If you're supposed to be hitting from the gold tees, hit from the gold tees. Pride will tell you never hit from the reds. Thank you. Done with that one. Okay. All right, but then again, if
you're like me and you don't have any, the reds are fine.
No, you do that, I will throw you off the course. the next part is, look, Kevin, for example, has a GPS, all right? And he'll go out there with his GPS, right? And you'll go, it's 156 yards.
Yes, I will.
Okay? What drives you nuts And what drives you nuts is I eyeball it and I tell you what.
155 yards.
Right. It doesn't matter. If it's 155 or 156 yards, I can look at the white stake or the white marker in the fairway, and I know approximately where I am. And guess what? I'm an 8-iron. That's the club I play. I don't need to go, okay, 1, 2, 3. Oh, God, I'm 155 and a half yards. Oh, come on. Okay? Okay, I don't have a caddy named Bones McKay next to me. Okay? I can look at it, and I know that 145 to 155, maybe 160 yards, I'm going to hit an 8-iron. If I'm 130 to 145, I'm probably going to hit a 9 based on what I know about my swing. Anything inside of 130, I'm hitting a sandwich. Okay? If I'm 200, I'm going to hit a 4-iron. If I'm 195, I'm going to hit a 4-iron. 190, I'm going to hit a 4-iron. Underneath that, I'll probably hit a 5. You know what your approximate skill level is. Okay? I mean, you should not have to sit there and go, okay, I've got my finder. I'm looking. Okay, I'm 156 yards. Okay, I think I'll pull a 7-iron. You're going to walk out if you know your game. Look, oh, you know what? I'm beyond 150 yards, but I'm only maybe 5 or 6 yards beyond. I'm going to pull a 7-iron. You have to know what your game is right away. These are all my good friend Dave Baker and I. Dave and I have been friends for 30 years. We've played plenty of golf together in our lifetime. Last year, he and I decided to go out and play a round of golf. All right, we got a cart. We played in 3 hours and 20 minutes. And we don't play speed golf. We don't sit there and, like, overthink what's going on. Look, and the other part is, if the ball's in the woods, I don't blame you for wanting to find the ball, okay, at all. Because I want to find mine. I don't want to lose the ball during the course of a round. But take 30 to 45 seconds, about approximately where you thought it went through, it went in, and go, okay, and if you see it, great. If you don't, take a drop and take a penalty stroke. Why? Because guess what? At our respective skill level, unless we're a single-digit handicap or maybe a handicap that's 12 and under, your odds of getting out of that woods successfully and really hitting the kind of shot that you dream of is just that, it's a dream.
And if you're just playing for fun and you're playing balls you can't afford to lose, you shouldn't be playing those golf balls anyway. I say that from my own experience.
Right. Golf balls are like Doritos. They make more. All right? I mean, none of us wants to lose a ball. You don't want to go through a round where you lose 3, 4 balls, 5 balls in a round. That's not fun, and I understand that. But when they were talking about this pace of play campaign, I mean, these are all things. They've lost, in 10 years, 4 million golfers. 10 years, 4 million fewer people playing golf. And I love the sport. Right? I mean, as I get older, I'm not quite as good as I used to be. I mean, the lowest I ever got in my lifetime was a 13 handicap. That's the lowest I ever got. Okay? Which isn't bad. Right? 13 handicap isn't bad. I mean, I was always kind of proud I was that. You know, but that's I'm probably an 18 now. Right? Older, can't hit the ball quite as far, shoulder bugs me, things like that. You know, and you play in a lot of scramble tournaments, that doesn't help, but I want to play more. So the fact that there are 4 million fewer of you out there makes it easier for me. No, just kidding. But that pace of play is important. Pace of play is important. You know, a guy rolls the ball up to within 2 feet of the hole. Concede the putt to your partner. Okay?
Unless he putts like concede me, and then you might want to have him putt it out.
Nah, concede it. What the heck? Come on.
And you know, you were talking about technology, and yes, I do use the GPS app on my phone. But I also make sure, but I also make sure I'm using it when someone else is hitting, so that I'm not holding anybody up by the time I get it out and get it all squared away. That's the big difference. It's the guys that wait until, and the ladies as well, that wait until it's their turn to hit, to get up to the ball. I got to be dead on the ball here. Where am I at?
Right, and you bring up a really good point, Kevin. When you're on the green, and say, for example, Kevin and I are playing around. Kevin's away, and so he's going to go up and putt. But I'm on the left-hand side. He's on the right side. Well, I go into a crouch on the right side, and I take a good look at my putt while he's putting. That way, when he rolls it up, I get up there, I'm ready to go. And all this, I'm going to walk to the other side, take a look. Oh, for goodness sake, hit the ball.
And I also, now I don't take many practice swings, if any practice swings when I come up. Depends on what kind of, how I feel the lie is and how I feel I'm hitting the ball. But.
Oh, I always take one.
Well, and it's, that's what I was just going to say. But it's okay to take one. But it's when you take three and four and it's in the middle of the fairway, that's another thing that slows play. And there's no reason for that. If you're near a tree and you're worried about hitting the club, you know, hitting the club on the backswing or finishing off, then you take a couple extra swings. Sure.
Right. And pace of play. Look, it's going to make it enjoyable for everyone out there. Now, I'm not saying everybody's going to play a 3-hour and 20-minute round of golf like Dave and I did, but it was an incredibly enjoyable day. We weren't out there for 5 hours grinding it out where you leave and you're complaining, God, that took forever. Which is why they feel pace of play is a problem. And now, again, golf courses have to do a better job of making the course playable. Players have to do a better job of all the things that we just listed. Golf course designers have to do a better job of, like, look, I'm going to go out and win an award. No, make a golf course people can play. Okay? Where they walk out and they say, I can't wait to come back. Time now for the Kevin Herr rant of the day.
Well, it's not about golf. It actually has something to do with last weekend's NASCAR race. And I was up there.
Let's take a break.
Well, and you
Let's
and I talked.
Take a break.
You and I talked about this a few minutes ago, and we've talked about this on the show many times. How arenas and events are doing more to bring the at-home feeling and the at-home television experience to the live event. We're talked about it with the NFL doing the first and 10 lines and the things that happen in the stadium, the replays on the scoreboard, just to make anything better in the event than at home. And one of the things that, that racing has done, and I'm wondering, is it gone too far now, is my point. They have a handheld video screen where you can create your own replay. You can watch the television broadcast. You can hear in-car audio from the drivers and the pit crews, and you can switch to any of the drivers you want, and you get multiple car angles as well. The problem I see with this is I think it's a great idea to have these available, but then I end up watching the screen and forgetting I'm actually at the race and can see the whole track.
Right. Well, you know what? First of all, let's take Pocono, for example. You're sitting in the grandstand at the Trioval. How much can you see in the backstretch?
Where I was, I could see the Long Pond straight to turn two. I lost the short chute into three.
Okay. Right. What if there's an accident in the short chute?
Exactly. I don't see it.
All right. This gives you the way to do it. At the U.S. Open, okay, I found some spots because I'd scouted out whatever because I'd walked the course extensively on Wednesday before the show. You know, then we had Dick on and a little bit of Matt Kuchar on and so forth, right? And I found a spot up on a hill at 9 where up at 9 I could see second fairway. I could see the fairway shots at 5. I could see the fairway and approach into 4 and all the putting at 4, the long par 5. And, of course, I could see the entire ninth hole, the par 3, and I could see the entire 10th hole. So I had a good look at so many players. Steve Stricker had a double on Saturday that happened in front of me, a double bogey. I saw Justin Rose. I saw him birdie 4. I saw him par 9. I saw him birdie 10. All right? Saw Mickelson birdie 10, par 4, par 9, par 5. I mean, so I saw all of that from one spot. But as I walked and worked my way through the course, you know what was extremely valuable to people? They had those little radios that they use at Penn State football games. Those little radios that had them hooked into the Bob Wershusen broadcast, right? And that's how fans were keeping track of what was going on in the course because you're still talking about 100 acres here of ground to cover and a lot of different players, and you can't see everybody at once. So you have to make, you know, so even something like that electronically is a big plus. So you as a fan in the short chute say there's an accident, in, you know, and you're one, you know, and they're coming through. Who does it involve? That will help you identify who's involved.
And that's great, but this is what I'm saying. This particular item went a little bit further than that by giving you different angles, different camera angles that you could watch. And that's where the problem, that's where I think it had has gone too far, because now I'm watching that instead of watching the race. It's like, wait a minute, why did I pay for a seat when I'm watching it on TV anyway? And that's where you have to
well,
be careful.
I'll say this. I'll say this. If they can do a better job, for, and I mean this in all sincerity, with radio broadcasts, that can be available to fans to use, okay, at a very nominal price, I mean small price, they could help themselves out exponentially in the stands because the announcers can help you keep track of what's going on. And I'll tell you, Penn State football, as you know, Jack and I look down, we can't believe the number of people have radios. But you know what? We identify who's doing what. It's like, they, you know, they can see it, but, like, we identify it for them as they go along. And, plus, Jack then analyzes everything for them. So, I mean, that's a part of technology. I think it's a huge plus where you supplement what you see with radios. They have to just do it cost-effectively where they feel like it's enhancing the in-stadium, in-race experience, on-course experience, and so forth, where people aren't spending armloads of money to get these things.
And that's where racing has done a better job, not necessarily with the cost end of it, but the availability, because the radio network that's carrying the race, whether it be IndyCar or NASCAR or Nationwide or whatever, is broadcast in the around the stands and in the track and in the infield, so you can actually hear it without a radio. Now, not as clearly as you would with a set of headphones, but you also have the opportunity when you have your in-car scanner, you can actually dial up the radio or television broadcast as well. And that's what I had when we were listening to some of the in-car communication. We could actually right. dial up the TNT or the radio broadcast as well. And that's where I think racing has done a better job than some of the other sports.
Right. I don't think you should be allowed to hear the in-car communication. If I was NASCAR,
I get that.
No, I wouldn't allow it.
No, I agree with your thought on that. I don't hearing it, but I understand what you're saying.
Okay, we don't hear what Bill O'Brien's play call is. All right. I think there's some things that in the strategy of what's going on, okay, has to be kept within the team. Whether it's football, whether it's basketball in the huddle, whether it's NASCAR communication from the pits to the driver and vice versa. You know, I think NASCAR made a mistake with that a long time ago, and it's going to be hard for them to rectify it because they won't be able to go back.
Yeah, and there's no way you can go back. It's there's too much money involved in it right now.
Yeah, I think when they did that, I found that to be a major mistake in what's going on because I call it brings us inside. You're not supposed to be inside. Okay, you don't sit down there in the huddle when they call the play.
Well, unless you're at the blue-white game.
Yeah, well, he did that for a couple plays. That's fine. That's an exhibition. I mean, there's a little bit difference between an exhibition and the real thing. You know, I mean, you're not down there with Dave Paulson or Patrick Chambers in their huddle listening to the play they diagram. Guess what? They come out of the huddle, and you're guessing just like everybody else is as to what they might do.
I see your point, and you have a great point. As a fan, though, and I really enjoyed that part of the race. That added an element that I really wasn't able to hear because I could listen to, you know, Danica going, hey, listen, the car is really tight coming out of three, but it's really loose going into one. What can we do about it? I see both sides of that, but the fan in me loves that ability.
Yeah, well, guess what? If they'd never done it, you never would have missed it.
Good point. Can't debate
They've
that.
Never
with
done
you.
It. You never would have missed it, right? You never would have missed it. Okay, and it's, you know, I just think that you know, in order, you can do too much access. I mean, for example, when we go out, let's do a radio example. We go out on location to Susquehanna Valley Country Club, like we did on June 5th. We wanted as many people to come out and see what we're doing, right? Okay, and be out there. We had several people come out and join us there. We had a great time with them. Okay, But do we want them in the studio when we're there right now in our place of business?
Are you kidding? They'll see everything I mess up. You have a valid point. You have a very valid point. But again, because I have it now, it's going to be real hard to take it away.
That's what I say. Taking it away would be, you can't do it now. Once you cross a certain line, you can't go back. Can't go back now. We'll wrap it up in a moment on News Radio 1070 WKOK.
See, now there's appropriate music since we were talking about NASCAR, Steve.
Right, absolutely.
From Days of Thunder.
Yes, indeed. Very nice. You kind of remind me in some ways of Tom Cruise.
I know I'm opening the door, but how's that, Steve? Before or after the concussion?
Since it's radio, women can dream. All right. As to what I mean by that.
Well, I thought you were going to say you reminded me of Tom Cruise playing Cole Trickle during the concussion scenes.
No, you kind of remind me more of Will Ferrell and Talladega Nights rolling on the track. Tell me Sean Carey's laughing.
Help me, Tom Cruise!
Fun day today. Tomorrow, by the way, how about this for a guest? Former Major League closer John Rocker.
Can you get some real guests on the show? Come on.
He'll join us tomorrow on the show.
That sounds great.
Looking forward to talking with John Rocker. Yep. He's involved in a great project right now. We're going to talk about a variety of things.